Hello and welcome to another deep dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your guide on this journey, ready to unpack the stories that matter most from today's Wall Street Journal.
And I'm Sam Astor, here to connect the dots, provide context, and explore the deeper implications of these headlines with you.
Today, we're taking a magnifying glass to the entire Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, September 3rd, 2025. Our mission is to navigate through the complex world of business, politics, global events, and culture, extracting the most important insights and surprising facts for you, our listener.
Think of it as your essential shortcut to being exceptionally well-informed. We'll cover every significant article, discuss the ripple effects, and make sure you walk away with a richer understanding of the forces shaping our world without feeling overwhelmed.
From major tech antitrust rulings and activist investor plays to shifting geopolitical alliances, domestic political battles, and even the surprising trends in our personal lives, we've got a lot to get through. So let's unpack this together. Let's jump straight into the top stories. And one that's certainly dominating the financial pages is the monumental Google antitrust case. A federal judge has finally ruled, and it seems Google dodged what could have been far more severe penalties. The judge said no to a Chrome spinoff, but yes to Google keeping its huge Apple deal. What's the real game changer here, and what did Judge Amit P. Mehta decide?
The core insight here, Alex, isn't just the specifics of the ruling, but the judge's surprisingly pragmatic view. I mean, he barred Google from exclusive search deals, which was a clear win for the Justice Department, targeting Google's decade-long monopolization of the search market.
Right.
But the real game changer is that he allowed Google to keep its Chrome browser and, crucially, maintain that high-stakes agreement with Apple. The Justice Department's request for a forced spinoff of Chrome was definitively rejected. The judge is essentially betting on market forces, specifically the disruptive power of AI, to reshape the tech landscape more effectively than, you know, any court order could.
And that Apple deal is absolutely massive, isn't it? I remember hearing it's a huge amount of money flowing between the two tech giants.
It is huge. Google currently pays Apple over $20 billion annually just to be the default search provider on Safari.
$20 billion, wow.
So by allowing this arrangement to continue, Wall Street analysts are calling this a huge win for both Google's parent company, Alphabet, and Apple. We saw Alphabet shares rise over 8% and Apple shares about 3% in aftermarket trading, clearly reflecting investor relief that this outcome is far better than feared.
So after Judge Mehta already ruled last year that Google illegally monopolized the search market for over a decade, using these very distribution agreements to maintain a staggering 90% market share. Why did he pull back on harsher remedies? Is this about the future or like a reluctance to interfere too much?
It's a bit of both, I think, but primarily a forward-looking perspective. Judge Mehta cited humility in crafting remedies, acknowledging that the competitive landscape is already rapidly changing, largely due to the advent of AI technology.
Okay.
He stated there were strong reasons not to jolt the system and to instead allow market forces to do the work. The thinking is that generative AI, with new AI companies emerging, is already posing a threat to Google's legacy search business, potentially fostering new competition organically.
Right. AI is changing everything.
Exactly. He also specifically noted that permitting payments to Apple prevents collateral damage, such as fewer products and less product innovation from Apple, which he viewed as detrimental to the broader tech ecosystem. He also rejected the Justice Department's proposal for choice screens on devices, deeming it an intrusion into product design, a line he felt courts shouldn't cross.
That's quite a pragmatic view, acknowledging both the existing power and the emerging threats. So what about the Justice Department? Are they satisfied with this outcome after a five-year legal battle?
Well, Assistant Attorney General Gail Slater, head of the Antitrust Division, indicated they are still studying if the decision goes far enough to restore competition. Google, for its part, quickly issued a statement saying the decision recognizes how much the industry has changed through the advent of AI and affirms that competition is intense. They did express some concerns about the data sharing requirements, though.
So what are the new requirements then?
So Google is now barred from striking exclusive deals for its search engine, Chrome, or any future AI products, and can't tie Android App Store licensing to using those products. They also must share some search data with competitors to help them build scale, though, importantly, not advertising data.
Okay.
For you, our listener, this means the future of the search engine you use, the competition for AI on your devices, and the broader digital services you interact with daily will continue to be shaped by these evolving dynamics, with AI potentially being the biggest disruptor of all.
While tech giants like Google are navigating complex legal battles that will shape the future of digital competition, We're seeing a very different kind of corporate shakeup in the world of consumer staples. Activist investor Elliott Management is now pushing for a major turnaround at PepsiCo with a substantial $4 billion stake. What are they looking to achieve here, and why now?
Yeah, this is a classic activist play, demonstrating how intense shareholder pressure can force established companies to reconsider their entire structure. Elliott has accumulated this significant $4 billion stake and now plans to push PepsiCo for changes they believe will boost its shares. PepsiCo has been facing intensified problems recently, largely due to tariffs and increasingly price-sensitive consumers.
Right, inflation hitting everyone.
Exactly, impacting its vast portfolio that includes Pepsi, Mountain Dew, Lay's, Doritos, and even recent acquisitions like Poppy and Seat Foods.
So what's Elliott's specific blueprint for this turnaround? What do they want?
Their primary proposal is to consider refranchising its bottling network. This isn't exactly a new idea in the industry. Rival Coca-Cola completed a similar initiative back in 2017, which significantly boosted its market value and share price.
Ah, okay. So there's precedent.
There is. The argument from some industry watchers is that PepsiCo's beverage business, which accounts for roughly 40% of its revenue, might fare better as a standalone entity, much like the food business. This idea has surfaced before. Activist Nelson Peltz unsuccessfully pushed for a beverage spinoff a decade ago. It's particularly relevant now because sales growth in PepsiCo's North America food business has slowed every quarter since late 2022.
The current CEO, Ramon LaGuardia, has been making efforts to improve performance, though. How does Elliott's intervention square with his strategy?
Lorda has certainly focused on improving consumer value, product placement, and new marketing campaigns, while also integrating the drink and snack businesses to cut costs, you know, things like single truck delivery. They've relaunched snack brands without artificial ingredients, and recent quarterly results in July showed some improvements in organic sales volume.
But clearly not enough for Elliott.
Apparently not. Elliott's move suggests they believe these operational improvements aren't enough, and a more radical structural change is needed to unlock significant shareholder value. Elliott, with over $76 billion under management, has a strong track record. They took a $5 billion stake in Honeywell late last year, pushed for a breakup, and eventually secured a board seat.
Right.
For you, our listener, this is a fascinating example of how activist investors can shape the products you consume and the companies you might invest in, highlighting the ongoing tension between short-term shareholder value and long-term company strategy.
Now to a significant legal ruling with broad political implications. A federal judge has ruled that President Trump's deployment of troops to Los Angeles was unlawful. Sam, this seems like a powerful affirmation of the limits of executive power.
It absolutely is, Alex, a major ruling. Federal Judge Breyer sided with California state officials, ruling that President Trump's deployment of troops, which included Federalized National Guard and Marines, was unlawful. The judge found there was no rebellion in Los Angeles and that civilian law enforcement was perfectly capable of responding to the protests.
And the key legal reason?
The core legal principle here is that the operation violated the 19th century Posse Comitatus Act, a long-standing law that essentially keeps the military out of domestic law enforcement.
What was the context of this deployment? Mm-hmm. What prompted President Trump to send in federal troops in the first place?
Well, the deployment was initiated after ICE raids in June, which were followed by protests in Los Angeles. Some protests did turn violent, leading President Trump to issue an order on June 7th, declaring them a form of rebellion against the authority of the government of the United States.
And the scale was quite large.
It was. At its peak, this involved 4,000 Federalized California National Guard troops and 700 Marines. While the operation has been winding down, about 300 California National Guard troops are still deployed, making the ruling's impact immediate.
And what are the immediate effects of Judge Breyer's ruling? What happens now?
The injunction, effective September 12th, requires the remaining National Guard troops to follow their initial training, which limits their duties. They cannot be expanded to include crowd control, traffic direction, or other functions that Judge Breyer explicitly stated were reserved for civilian law enforcement.
And the political reaction.
California Attorney General Rob Bonta, a Democrat, was quick to state that the ruling affirms President Trump is not king and the power of the executive is not boundless, describing the deployment as political theater.
I can imagine the White House had a strong reaction to this.
They did. White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly responded by stating that far-left courts try to stop President Trump from carrying out his mandate to make America safe again, and affirmed he is committed to protecting law-abiding citizens. This signals a clear intent to push back.
And Trump himself?
Well, President Trump frequently suggests expanding military presence domestically. And on Tuesday, he said he planned to approve federal intervention to address crime in Chicago. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is already bracing for potential immigration agents and National Guard deployments from other states. Judge Breyer specifically cited controversial incidents, like Operation Excalibur in MacArthur Park, which involved a show of force with Humvees, as examples of the Guard engaging in prohibited actions.
Well, quite specific examples.
Yes. For you, our listener, this ruling impacts the delicate balance of power between federal and state governments, the limits of executive authority regarding domestic law enforcement, and the crucial implications for civil liberties and protest rights across the country.
From the halls of government to the corporate boardroom, we're seeing a fascinating, if unfortunate, story of corporate governance and leadership at Nestlé. The CEO, Laurent Freixe, was dismissed after just 1 year, and the unraveling reportedly started with a tip to an employee hotline. Sam, this is a stark reminder about corporate ethics, isn't it?
It absolutely is, Alex. This case underscores that corporate ethics policies, especially around personal conduct, are taken very seriously by large global corporations like Nestlé and can lead to swift, high-level consequences. Laurent Freixe was dismissed for having an undisclosed intimate relationship with a marketing executive who reported directly to him a clear violation of the company's code of conduct.
How did the company even discover this, and how thorough was their investigation? It started with a hotline tip.
That's right, an anonymous tip to Nestlé's internal Speak Up hotline. Initially, yeah. Both individuals denied any relationship. However, it took two subsequent investigations, more hotline reports, and eventually a direct letter to the Nestlé chairman before the company took decisive action.
So it wasn't immediate.
No, it took some persistence. Outside investigators from the law firm Bear and Carr were brought in to review Freixe's personal data, including texts and photos, which provided clear evidence of the intimate relationship. This diligence highlights Nestlé's commitment to its corporate culture and standards. Their code specifically requires disclosure of personal relationships to avoid conflicts of interest.
And this happens often, these kinds of reports.
Apparently so. The company reported receiving over 3,000 conduct reports in 2024 alone, leading to 644 substantiated cases and 119 employee departures. So they clearly have a system for dealing with this.
This must throw the company into considerable disarray, especially after previous leadership changes.
It does. It's quite disruptive. This dismissal throws Nestlé into disarray, particularly after its previous CEO was also ousted for underperformance. The new Swiss successor, Philipp Navratil, who was 49 and previously served as CEO of Nespresso, now faces the significant task of restoring calm and reversing a years-long slide in the company's shares.
And this focus on governance is important for investors.
Very much so. Analyst Jean-Philippe Burchi of Vontobel emphasized the importance of abiding by American corporate governance standards for U.S. investors, even for a Swiss-based company, suggesting these global standards are becoming increasingly universal. During his brief tenure, Freixe had focused on core brands like Nescafe, Kit Kat, and Fancy Feast, slashing costs and shoring up the executive team. He had even ruffled some feathers internally by criticizing his predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
For you, our listener, this case reveals how deeply corporate ethics policies can impact leadership and accountability in a large global corporations.
Shifting gears, let's talk about something a bit more, shall we say, airborne. For private pilots, flying a plane is fun until you enter restricted airspace, and apparently this is happening more often than we might think. Sam, an F-16 pilot signaling WTF, that's quite a visual. How often is this actually happening?
Yeah, wow, an F-16 pilot signaling WTF. That's a story. It sounds almost comical, but it's a terrifying scenario for a hobby pilot, I'm sure. The article highlights that an increasing number of private pilots are inadvertently entering restricted airspace, leading to these dramatic intercepts by fighter jets.
So it's becoming more common.
It seems so. This is a surprisingly high-stakes scenario that's becoming more common. The North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, has intercepted 37 civilian aircraft by August 21st this year, putting them on track to roughly match last year's total of 72 intercepts. Before 2017, NORAD hadn't topped 40 annually, so the increase is significant.
These Top Gun moments, as the article calls them, sound intense. What usually triggers these temporary flight restrictions, or TFRs?
These TFRs, yeah, they're put in place around presidential travel or high-profile events like the Super Bowl. These violations can happen a few times a week, sometimes surging on weekends. The article shares that anecdote about hobby pilot Dennis Fitzgerald, 64, who described an F-16 pulling up next to his Cessna after he entered restricted airspace near then-President Biden's home state of Delaware.
And it was a software error.
His error was attributed to a flight planning program failing to refresh with the latest warnings. Simple mistake, big consequences.
What's the protocol if you find yourself in that situation? And are there serious consequences? I mean, besides the shock.
Air Force officials advise pilots to remain calm, rock their wings to signal they've received the message, and get on the emergency radio frequency. If they don't, the fighters will escalate, sometimes performing headbutt maneuvers or even deploying flares to get attention. While fighters cost taxpayers roughly $10,000 per hour to operate, pilots aren't billed. However, violators do face FAA sanctions and can be interviewed by law enforcement like the Secret Service or state police upon landing. The article shares another anecdote about Dennis Pelletier, Fitzgerald's co-owner, who was detained on Thanksgiving 2001 after being intercepted near Camp David due to expanded flight restrictions post 9/11.
So, real consequences.
Definitely. This whole system, known as Operation Noble Eagle, was launched after 9/11 to intercept rogue aircraft, and importantly, NORAD has never actually shot down a private plane. For you, our listener, this reveals the invisible rules of the air, how evolving security measures impact recreational activities, and the surprisingly high-stakes nature of seemingly simple navigation errors in our increasingly monitored skies.
Now, a deep dive into the internal dynamics of the Make America Healthy Again movement, or MAHA, which is now firmly ensconced within the Department of Health and Human Services under Robert F. Kennedy Jr., it seems there's significant turmoil and infighting, and it's about much more than just vaccines.
Yeah, this is a critical story about the challenges of governing when an administration is composed of a diverse and often fractious coalition. While Robert F. Kennedy Jr. chose Dr. Vinay Prasad, a prominent COVID vaccine critic, as the FDA's chief scientific officer, a seemingly fitting choice for the MAHA movement, Prasad quickly found himself at odds with other MAHA factions.
How so?
Well, for example, his limited approvals of mRNA products didn't satisfy those who wanted an immediate ban on all mRNA COVID shots. He was even criticized for his prior progressive politics. Prasad actually resigned under pressure, but was reinstated after Kennedy and FDA Commissioner Marty McCarry lobbied for him.
That's quite a turnaround.
It is. And what's truly remarkable is that even his commute became an issue, spending only 3 days out of every 2 weeks at FDA HQ in Maryland, with the agency footing the bill for his cross-country commute from California, despite the administration's push for in-office work.
So internal friction seems to be a major theme here. That sounds like a tough environment for anyone.
Indeed. The turmoil escalated further with the firing of Susan Monterez, the CDC director, just weeks after her Senate confirmation. She was let go after she declined to approve vaccine recommendations from a Kennedy-selected panel. White House spokeswoman Caroline Leavitt made the administration's stance clear. If people are not aligned, then we will gladly show them the door.
Wow, pretty blunt.
Very blunt. Indicates a strong top-down approach to policy alignment. Kennedy's allies have clashed not just among themselves, but also with the White House and other parts of the broader MAGA movement that don't fully embrace MAA-specific goals. Kennedy advisor Callie Means noted the visceral frustration still among many in the MA base.
And MAHA itself is quite a broad church, isn't it? Beyond vaccines, what other issues are causing these internal clashes? It's not just about shots.
No, it's much broader. The movement encompasses a wide range of supporters. Medical freedom activists who decry vaccine mandates, healthy food advocates pushing to ban artificial dyes, and critics of pesticides and microplastics. However, even within these groups, there are disagreements. Some MAHA supporters wanted an immediate ban on mRNA COVID shots, while others fault Kennedy for perceived selling out, such as suggesting the use of wearable health gadgets.
So internal policy debates, too.
Yes, and personality clashes. Dr. Prasad also faced criticism for his prior opposition to a Sarepta therapeutics treatment. Weeks after he joined the FDA, the agency waged an aggressive campaign against Sarepta, which even unnerved Republicans like Senator Ron Johnson, a close Kennedy ally. These internal battles extended to Kennedy's own staff, with his chief of staff, Heather Flick, and top policy aide, Hannah Anderson, being ousted.
Wasn't there some drama with Anderson?
Reportedly, yeah. Anderson allegedly backed her car into Kennedy's vehicle after being fired, which really gives you a sense of the emotional intensity of these internal disputes. The tensions are even wavering into areas like pesticides and forever chemicals for some activists.
Okay.
For you, our listener, these deep internal political and ideological divisions within an administration can significantly impact public health policy, raising serious questions about scientific integrity and public trust in vital institutions like the FDA and CDC.
Okay, let's pivot to the world of business and finance, and a story about a giant in our pantries. Kraft Heinz is splitting into two companies, unwinding a mega merger from 2015. Sam, is this a smart move, or is Kraft Heinz simply trying to put lipstick on a pig?
That's a great question, because this is a significant strategic reversal, moving away from the industry trend of building scale. Kraft Heinz plans to split into two separate companies, one global company focusing on sauces, spreads, and seasonings, think Heinz ketchup, right? And another selling grocery staples primarily in North America, like Oscar Mayer.
And the reason.
The motivation, according to the company, is to create more focused and less complex businesses. This split comes after Kraft Heinz has struggled with a flagging share price, down 27% in the last year, and weakening demand for some of its core products, including Lunchables, Capri Sun, macaroni and cheese, and mayonnaise. They even posted a staggering $9.3 billion non-cash impairment charge, basically a write-down of asset value in the last quarter reflecting that decline.
So the CEO, Abrams Rivera, is citing complexity as the main hindrance. But if Buffett, their largest shareholder, is against it, is Kraft Heinz truly making a mistake by going against his advice? He's usually got a good sense for these things.
Buffett's rarely wrong on these things, yeah. And he told the Wall Street Journal that the plan is costly and disruptive, doesn't create value, and that shareholders should have had a vote. Berkshire Hathaway, which holds over 27% of Kraft Heinz, doesn't favor the split, with Buffett himself famously saying it does not do a thing, you know, for what the ketchup tastes like.
Classic Buffett.
Right. But CEO Abrams Rivera cited the sheer complexity of Kraft Heinz's business. Nearly 200 brands across 55 categories in 150 countries as a hindrance to proper investment and focus. He believes the split will allow the North America staples business, for example, to focus on a smaller geography and expand into channels like convenience stores, which they haven't prioritized before.
It sounds like a challenging endeavor, even if it's part of a wider trend for some companies these days.
It is. Corporate breakups are certainly in vogue, with examples like Kellogg splitting in 2023 and Keurig Dr. Pepper unwinding a 2018 transaction. But disentangling a business of this scale presents significant challenges. Analyst Robert Moskow noted the complexity in untangling their operating framework and existing partnerships with tech giants like Microsoft and Google, in addition to the previous consolidation of facilities by 3G Capital.
Yeah, that sounds messy.
The split is expected to complete in the second half of 2026, with the board actively seeking candidates for the global business leadership. For you, our listener, this shows how strategic corporate decisions reflect wider economic pressures and consumer trends, and it definitely raises questions about what this means for those familiar brands in your pantry and on your grocery shelves.
Speaking of market forces, let's look at the regional banking sector. An activist investor, Holdco Asset Management, is pushing for Comerica to sell itself, and is even threatening a board fight. Sam, is this simply Wall Street impatience, or does it signal deeper problems in regional banking?
I think it signals a growing impatience among investors for consolidation in the regional banking sector, Alex, and perhaps deeper underlying pressures. Holdco Asset Management, with a 1.8% stake in Comerica worth about $160 million, plans to launch a board fight if the regional bank doesn't explore a sale.
And why consolidation?
Well, regional banks are under significant pressure to merge to better compete with larger institutions like JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America, and investors are clearly tired of waiting for these strategic moves to materialize organically.
How has Comerica been performing to warrant this kind of activist attention? Have they been struggling?
Yeah, Comerica's shares have significantly underperformed its bank peers, falling nearly 30% over the last 7 years, while the broader banking index has actually risen. The bank has also been struggling with a botched technology upgrade, which has undoubtedly added to investor frustration.
So Holdco means business.
Seems like it. Their threat is serious. If no sale is pursued, they plan to nominate around 5 directors to Comerica's 11-person board by December. This strategy has some backing. Wells Fargo analyst Mike Mayo, who pushed for a Comerica sale a decade ago, estimated a takeover price of $90 per share, which would represent a 25-30% premium.
And we're seeing other deals.
Yes. This push for M&A is gaining traction across the sector, with Pinnacle Financial Partners and Synovus Financial recently announcing an $8.6 billion all-stock merger, indicating movement in the mid-size bank space. For you, our listener, this demonstrates how activist investors can shape the banking landscape and potentially influence the financial institutions you interact with, highlighting the intense pressures on regional banks in today's economy.
From banking to groceries, there's another major player making aggressive moves. The German discount grocer Aldi wants to conquer the U.S. grocery store landscape. Sam, is this just a discount grocer expanding, or does it represent a fundamental shift in how Americans shop for food?
This is definitely a story about capitalizing on shifting consumer behavior, Alex, and it points to a fundamental shift, I think. Aldi is undertaking its biggest ever U.S. expansion, planning to add over 200 stores in 2025, which makes it America's fastest growing retailer after dollar stores.
And their strategy, low prices, basically.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Their strategy is straightforward.
Oh.
They're capitalizing on inflation-weary shoppers who are seeking lower prices, but also increasingly want organic produce and select cut meats. Aldi's cost-cutting model is incredibly efficient. Products are displayed directly in crates for shelving, stores are smaller than traditional supermarkets, and about 90% of their offerings are private label. This allows them to deliver significantly lower prices.
That's an impressive growth rate. How widespread is their presence, and where are they targeting next? Are they everywhere?
They're getting there. Aldi is already the third largest grocery chain by store count in the U.S., with over 2,500 locations. Nearly half of their 2025 openings are conversions of acquired Winn-Dixie and Harvey's supermarket locations, and they plan to add over 800 more stores by the end of 2028.
Wow.
What's particularly notable is their push into New York City, where they plan to open their largest NYC store near Times Square next summer, targeting both tourists and the growing residential population there.
Interesting. And they have that treasure hunt thing too, right?
Yeah, they offer a treasure hunt experience with their Aldi Finds aisle, which features rotating discounted items similar to retailers like TJX and Five Below, adding an element of discovery to shopping. The broader consumer shift indicates that American shoppers are becoming more amenable to smaller formats and private labels, a trend significantly accelerated by high inflation, which drove many shoppers to Aldi in the first place.
Okay.
For you, our listener, Aldi's expansion could directly impact your shopping habits, offering new options for saving money, and it certainly intensifies the competitive landscape of the entire food industry.
Let's turn our attention to the global energy markets, where we have two interconnected stories. First, OPEC Plus is set to hold output steady, even as anxieties about an oil glut loom. And then there's the fascinating unintended consequence of Trump's India tariffs, which are actually being blunted by the black market for oil. Sam, talk about unintended consequences. What's happening here?
This is a fascinating paradox in the oil market, Alex, and a prime example of how geopolitical maneuvers can backfire. OPEC Plus members are expected to hold output steady on Sunday, despite anxieties over a global supply glut. They had previously approved unwinding 2.2 million barrels per day of voluntary cuts a year early, but the expected glut hasn't quite shown up in inventory data, partly due to strong summer demand and builds in China.
So the market's tighter than expected.
Seems that way for now. HSBC is forecasting Brent crude at $65 a barrel in Q4 and through 2026, which is a key benchmark price.
So the tariffs, they were meant to punish India for buying cheap Russian crude, but instead they made the Russian oil even cheaper. How does that work?
Precisely. It's quite something. The White House's 50% import levy on India, intended to punish New Delhi for buying cheap Russian crude, is actually backfiring. The tariff has made Russia's already discounted oil even cheaper for India, costing about $1 less per barrel than before the tariffs.
And the black market is adapting.
Oh, yeah. The black market for oil, by the way, is incredibly sophisticated. The amount of crude under Western sanctions is at a record high 15% of the world's supply, and the fleet of shattered vessels for illicit crude has quadrupled since Russia's energy sanctions were imposed 3 years ago.
This policy is pushing New Delhi closer to Russia and China. This highlights a conflicted U.S. policy, doesn't it? Almost working against itself.
It absolutely does. The U.S. and Europe previously benefited from India buying Russian crude because it helped keep global energy prices in check. The U.S. hasn't been as aggressive against China's sanctioned oil imports either. This policy is clearly pushing New Delhi closer to Russia and China. Indian Prime Minister Modi recently visited China, and India's foreign minister visited Moscow, where they agreed to increase bilateral trade by 50% over the next 5 years. For you, our listener, these geopolitical tensions and trade policies directly impact global energy markets and your fuel prices, demonstrating how sanctions, while perhaps well-intentioned, can lead to complex and unintended consequences in a globally interconnected world.
Global economic anxieties seem to be rippling through the financial markets. U.S. stocks kicked off September on a down note amid a rise in bond yields. Sam, is this just a September slump, or are there deeper concerns at play here?
We're seeing a clear reaction to renewed inflation and debt concerns that have sparked a global bond sell-off, Alex. U.S. stocks fell, with the NASDAQ composite down 0.8%, the S&P 500 down 0.7%, and the Dow Jones dropping 249 points. Historically, September is the worst performing month for the S&P 500, with an average loss of 2%, so this start is fitting, if unwelcome.
And this began in Europe. What's spooking them over there?
Yes, the jitter started in the European trading day, where bond yields on long-dated UK, German, French, Italian, and Dutch government debt all surged to decade-plus highs. The UK's 30-year gilt, for instance, hit 5.7%, a level not seen since 1998. Investors across the Atlantic are growing uneasy, with higher government debt being used to finance defense and infrastructure spending at a time when the European economy has grown stagnant. There are particular concerns about France facing a confidence vote and Germany's military spending plans impacting its typically safe bonds. Adding to the angst was an unexpected 2.1% year-over-year Eurozone inflation rate in August.
And how is the U.S. bond market reacting to all this? Are we seeing similar spikes?
The U.S. Treasury bonds posted more modest declines, with the 10-year Treasury yield rising to 4.276%. American investors are also concerned with President Trump's campaign to reshape the Federal Reserve as they await a court ruling on whether his bid to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook will be allowed to proceed.
Right, that adds another layer of uncertainty.
It does. The president has urged the central bank to cut interest rates, fueling concerns about inflation and longer-term risks to the Fed's independence. Compounding this, an appeals court struck down Trump's reciprocal tariffs, raising worries about lower tariff revenues and wider deficits, further impacting bond market stability.
So a real ripple effect.
The result was a broad impact on assets. Real estate, tech stocks, and other riskier assets fell, while the dollar rose, and gold hit a new all-time high of $3,549.40 per ounce. All eyes are now on the August jobs report this Friday, which will significantly influence the Fed's rate-setting meeting, where a cut is currently expected. So for you, our listener, global economic anxieties and domestic policy decisions are directly affecting your investments and the broader financial market.
From global markets to our living rooms, the NFL is throwing a penalty flag at Nielsen, the long-standing audience measurement company. They're criticizing Nielsen's measurements as the football season approaches. Sam, is this a fair complaint, or is the NFL just trying to squeeze more money out of their deals?
Well, it's probably a bit of both, but it's a critical discussion about how media content is valued in an increasingly fragmented landscape, Alex. NFL Chief Data and Analytics Officer Paul Ballou says Nielsen systematically undercounts game viewership, and that this could potentially hurt ad revenue and the value of media rights.
And those rights are worth billions.
Exactly. The league's media deals run through 2033, with an option to reopen in 2029, so accurate audience ratings are absolutely key for them in setting advertising rates and negotiating content value.
What's Nielsen's response to these accusations, and what improvements have they made? Are they just sitting back?
No, a Nielsen spokeswoman stated they are confident this will be the most accurately rated football season in history, and that they are working closely with the NFL to innovate data collection. Nielsen has made improvements, launching a Big Data Plus panel methodology that tracks data from 45 million homes and 75 million devices, on top of their traditional panel. They've also worked to improve streaming and out-of-home viewing measurement.
So, despite those efforts, why are the NFL's concerns persisting? What's still missing?
Ballou still has several key concerns. He points out that the Big Data Plus panel doesn't yet include first-party audience data from most of the streaming services that carry NFL games, which is crucial.
Ah, okay, that's a big gap.
It is. There's also a long-standing concern about the underrepresentation of co-viewing people watching games together at home, which Nielsen says it will provide a deeper co-viewing analysis for. Additionally, the NFL is frustrated by increasing delays in restatements of ratings by Nielsen, which creates uncertainty in the advertising marketplace.
Oh, looking elsewhere.
They are. The NFL, along with ESPN, is even experimenting with VideoAmp, another measurement firm, though Nielsen criticizes VideoAmp's methodology and accuracy, asserting its own accreditation by the Media Rating Council as a differentiator. So for you, our listener, how what you watch is measured directly impacts the entertainment industry, from the cost of commercials to the value of your favorite sports league.
Let's talk about corporate earnings, because it seems we're seeing strong numbers, but there's a disconnect, Sam. Are corporate profits being driven by a strong economy or something else entirely? It feels like maybe the numbers don't tell a whole story.
This is a crucial look behind the curtain of corporate performance, Alex, and you're right, there's more to it. Strong corporate earnings are being driven more by expense reduction and efficiency measures, such as job cuts and price hikes, rather than robust consumer spending. This raises an important question about the sustainability of these profits and the health of the broader economy.
And economists are worried.
Some are. Gregory Dacco, chief economist at EY Parthenon, notes that these cuts haven't yet led to the deep business or consumer spending downturns that typically precede recessions. But he fears that the longer this lasts, the more likely we are to enter something akin to a downturn.
So corporate bottom lines are improving, but worker and consumer sentiment isn't. That sounds like a recipe for trouble down the line.
Exactly. Consumer sentiment actually declined in August, and inflation expectations worsened, remaining above the Fed's targets. Employee surveys suggest many are doing more with less, with over 40% of global professionals in a Korn Ferry poll reporting slashed management ranks, leading to feelings of directionlessness and insecurity. Many managers and employees alike expect a recession within the next year.
And we're seeing this at the checkout, too.
Definitely. On the shopper side, consumers are clearly reining in spending. Companies like Walmart, Advance Auto Parts, and Kohl's report customers cutting discretionary spending or trading down to cheaper goods and generic brands. Atlanta Fed President Raphael Bostic notes that middle and low-income shoppers are stretching out perishable goods. Diners at IHOP, McDonald's, and Denny's are seeking deals, while lower-income individuals are staying away altogether.
Is this hitting everyone equally, or are there different segments of the economy experiencing this differently? Like,
yeah.
Are the rich still spending?
There's a clear divergence, yeah. High earners are still buying luxury items, such as on running shoes that start at $160 a pair, and first-class flights. United Airlines reported a 5.6% increase in premium cabin revenue, while its economy cabin revenue was negative.
Interesting contrast.
Very. Mm-hmm. In contrast, discount retailers like Dollar General and budget airlines like Frontier and Spirit are struggling more than high-end counterparts. Crocs CEO Andrew Rees noted that less wealthy shoppers are paring back spending and are most sensitive to price increases. This is a stark illustration of how the economy is performing differently for different income brackets.
And buybacks play a role.
They do. It's also worth noting that share buybacks added about 1.3 percentage points to the S&P 500's gains in Q2, mechanically boosting earnings per share without necessarily reflecting operational improvements. For you, our listener, this reveals what's truly driving corporate profits today and highlights the potential disconnect between corporate performance and worker and consumer sentiment, impacting your financial well-being and outlook.
Let's turn to the fintech world. Klarna, the buy now, pay later giant, is seeking to raise up to $1.46 billion in a New York IPO. Sam, this is a big move for them, but is the market ready for another BNPL giant to go public, especially after they hesitated before?
This is a significant development, yeah, especially since Klarna backed out of IPO plans in April amid market uncertainty after the Trump administration's tariffs. Now they're looking to raise up to $1.46 billion, with the company's market value estimated around $14 billion at the top end of the $35-$37 per share pricing range.
And the BNPL market is still hot.
The buy now, pay later industry, or BNPL, has exploded, and Klarna is pushing to become a full-fledged bank, having recently launched a U.S. debit card in partnership with Visa.
That's a huge shift from just being a lending service. What kind of growth are they seeing that makes them confident now? Are they signing up lots of stores?
They've seen remarkable growth, increasing their merchant base by 202,000 in the past year alone. They're becoming the exclusive BNPL provider at Walmart in the U.S., rolling out on eBay U.S., and expanding their services to Nexi, WorldPay, and JP Morgan payments in the coming months.
Okay, so big partnerships.
Huge. With 111 million active consumers and 790,000 merchants, Klarna clearly has a substantial footprint. They will be listing ordinary shares on the NYSE under the symbol KLAR. For you, our listener, this IPO tells us a lot about the rapid growth and future of BNPL services you might use and the evolving landscape of fintech. It shows how consumer financing models are changing and attracting significant investment despite past market jitters.
Here's a story that feels like something out of a quirky documentary. Meet the guy who drives a street-legal Chinese EV in the U.S. Eric Soderholm, 71, of Honolulu, drives one of only a handful of fully registered BYD E6 Chinese-made EVs in the U.S., despite hefty regulatory defenses, specifically tariffs of over 100% against such vehicles. Sam, what does this rare sight reveal about global auto trade? It seems almost impossible.
This is a fascinating anecdote that highlights the complexities and often unintended consequences of global auto trade and protectionist policies, Alex. Soderholm's car, a boxy SUV, is an early, low-tech BYD E6 model from the 2010s. He actually owns four of the mere six registered E6s in the U.S.
Only six in the whole country.
That's what the article says. He's put 60,000 miles on his, and his service manager has cleared 100,000 on another. What's remarkable is that these cars are practically ghosts in the U.S. market.
So how did they even get here in the first place with such high tariffs in place now? Was there a window?
Yeah, BYD, the Chinese automaker, did try to break into the U.S. market in the 2010s. They signed deals in 2015 with Uber and taxi fleets, though a Cars.com review from that time called the E6 rough around the edges, noting uneven braking, steering, and charging issues with its 180-mile range.
And Soderholm tried to be a dealer.
Exactly. His unique role came from his attempt to become BYD's first and only U.S. dealer, striking a deal in 2016. However, that deal was rescinded in 2018, with BYD leadership claiming unawareness, leading to a legal battle that was eventually settled out of court.
So they pulled back.
Seems like it. Historically, BYD imported 80 E6s certified with federal motor vehicle safety standards, but none after 2016. Soderholm sees the E6's functionality and BYD's potential as a genuine threat to the U.S. auto market, underscoring the effectiveness of these protectionist measures. For you, our listener, this rare sight reveals a lot about global auto trade, the impact of protectionist policies, and the significant challenges of market entry for international brands, even when they've proven their product works.
San Francisco's office market, which has been quite a hard luck case post-pandemic, seems to be experiencing a sign of life, driven largely by AI firms. We're even hearing about plans for a new 12,225-foot office tower. Sam, is this a real comeback or just an AI-fueled mirage for the city?
This is a fascinating story about how quickly a single powerful industry can reshape a struggling real estate market, Alex. AI firms are leading a significant revival of San Francisco's office market, with leasing activity reportedly back to pre-pandemic levels. This renewed confidence is so strong that Hines, a real estate investment manager, has launched a city review for a planned 1,225-foot office tower, which, if built, would be the tallest on the West Coast.
This is a dramatic turnaround from the post-pandemic landscape where vacancy rates soared, right? Everyone thought SF was over.
Absolutely. Before COVID-19, San Francisco's tech sector was the darling of commercial property. But the pandemic led to soaring vacancy rates and nosediving values, largely because the tech sector was slower to return to in-office work. Now, AI companies like OpenAI, Anthropic, Datablock, and Scale AI are driving demand.
How much space are we talking?
OpenAI alone controls close to 1 million square feet and is looking for more. AI companies leased about 1 million square feet in 2025 alone and are expected to occupy 15 million square feet by 2030. This growth is also buoyed by new leadership, with Mayor Daniel Lurie supporting the Hines project and taking steps to reduce homelessness and crime. Institutional investors like Blackstone are also buying properties at deep discounts, signaling renewed confidence.
But is it a full-blown boom yet? Or are there nuances we should be aware of? Are these AI companies really filling up these massive spaces with lots of people?
That's a critical nuance, yeah. The market is still far from booming. Established tech companies are growing slowly. Amazon, for example, is using AI to reduce its workforce. And while AI companies raise billions, they often have few employees, which makes analysts question the direct benefits for landlords.
So tenants still have leverage.
Definitely. Tenants still have the advantage in negotiations, often getting significant concessions like more than a year of free rent on long-term leases, and many businesses are still taking less space due to new workplace strategies. However, Hines' global CIO, David Steinbach, sees resemblance to the tech growth of 2012, betting on early development in a market with years of no new supply, believing the market will reward early movers.
Interesting gamble.
For you, our listener, the resurgence of San Francisco's office market, driven by AI, offers insights into the future of work, the evolving nature of urban centers, and the resilience and adaptability of the real estate industry.
Now, for a quick run through of some other business and finance headlines you should know. First, an unusual scandal in corporate Japan. The CEO of Jim Beam's Japanese owner, Suntory Holdings, quit during a police probe over whether he purchased illegal supplements.
Yeah, that's quite rare in corporate Japan. And then there was a COVID-era biopharma venture, Bedmar, an affiliate of National Resilience, whose manufactured bankruptcy case was dismissed. The judge ruled its financial distress was basically concocted just to get out of lease liabilities.
Interesting. It's interesting how these smaller stories can reveal underlying issues within industries, from corporate governance in Japan to the challenges of scaling up biopharmaceutical manufacturing in the U.S. in a post-pandemic world.
Exactly.
Shifting to media, Vogue has tapped a new U.S. editor, Chloe Mao, 39, marking a new era for the iconic magazine. She succeeds Anna Wintour, 75, after her 37-year tenure, signaling a shift toward a more approachable, digitally focused leadership, given Mel previously doubled Vogue.com's traffic.
Pretty big change there.
On the economic front, ocean shipping rates are sinking, with rates from China to the U.S. West Coast falling 68% from their June high. This signals an earlier and shorter peak shipping season, with importers balking at trade upheaval, tariff uncertainties, and consumer spending concerns.
Yeah, the change at Vogue certainly marks a generational shift in leadership for a cultural institution. While the shipping rates story highlights the immediate impact of global trade policies and consumer sentiment on logistics and supply chains, it's a clear indicator of caution among businesses.
And further reflecting consumer weakness, Constellation Brands, the importer of Modelo and Corona, cut its fiscal year outlook due to widespread consumer weakness, particularly among Hispanic consumers, amid immigration crackdowns.
Specific demographic impact there.
In a more positive financial note, some hedge funds won big on an obscure French drug maker, Abivax, which surged almost 600% in one day after positive late-stage trial results for an inflammatory bowel disease drug. This delivered big gains for biotech hedge funds that had struggled this year.
Wow, a 600% surge, huge win for them.
Finally, a fascinating business model from China. Mixi Ice Cream and Tea, now the world's largest fast food chain by locations, sells 700 million 40-cent ice cream cones annually, perfecting making money by losing money through high-low pricing, signaling bargains, and leveraging social media for free media.
These headlines reinforce several themes we've already touched upon. The impact of consumer confidence, the high-stakes world of biotech investing, and innovative, often counterintuitive, business models emerging from global markets. And don't forget the corrections. Intel CEO is Liputan. Kim Jong-un photo was from a different date. Aldi NYC store opens next summer. Always good to see the journal correcting the record.
Absolutely. Keeps everyone honest. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's shift our focus to geopolitics and world affairs and a major development between two global powers.
Yeah.
Russia and China are closing in on a pipeline deal. Sam, this seems like a critical development, but are they truly allies, or is China simply exploiting Russia's vulnerability? It feels like the latter.
That's a crucial question, Alex, and you're probably right, because this is a critical development that underscores the shifting global power dynamics. Following talks between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping in Beijing, a legally binding memorandum was signed to build the power of Siberia 2 natural gas pipeline. This project would significantly boost Russian gas deliveries to China and tighten ties between the two nations as their relationship with the U.S. deteriorates.
But the devil's in the details.
Exactly. The core insight here is that terms like pricing, financing, and the construction timetable remain unresolved, signaling Beijing's growing leverage over Moscow.
So China is in a position to dictate terms because Russia needs a new buyer more than China needs their gas. They lost Europe as a customer.
Precisely. China has other natural gas options, including abundant LNG, that's liquefied natural gas from the Middle East, and new capacity coming online. This allows them to demand better terms, exploiting Russia's urgency to find new markets after Western sanctions following the Ukraine invasion drastically reduced its gas exports to Europe.
And Russia knows this.
Oh, they must. Moscow actually expects to sell gas to China at a lower price than it charged European customers. Analyst Alexander Gabuov noted that the relationship is becoming increasingly asymmetrical, with China holding all the cards, especially as Russia's window to access the Chinese market narrows due to China's decarbonization efforts.
And it's not just energy, right? This dependency runs deeper.
It does. This dependency is not just about energy. Sanctions have pushed Moscow and Beijing closer, making Russia reliant on China for technology with military applications, such as optics, microelectronics, and drone engines.
What about China's historical hesitations about relying too heavily on a single supplier? Weren't they worried about that?
That's been a long-standing concern for Beijing, yeah, which has an informal cap of around 20% on imports from a single supplier. This, along with disagreements over pricing and ownership, has delayed the project for years. However, the recent war between Israel and Iran has made Beijing reconsider the reliability of its energy supplies from the Middle East, potentially making a deal with Russia more attractive for energy security reasons.
So regional instability pushes them together.
It seems so. While China accounts for about a third of Russia's overall trade, Russia makes up less than 5% of China's trade, which further illustrates the power imbalance. For you, our listener, this deal highlights how global power shifts and regional conflicts are reshaping international energy markets and economic dependencies, which can have ripple effects on global stability and your own energy costs.
From energy deals to an isolated leader, Kim Jong-un's missiles fly, but he doesn't. He took a slow 20-hour train ride to Beijing for a gathering of global leaders right after touring a missile facility. Sam, what does this seemingly small detail reveal about his regime? It seems almost archaic.
This detail, while seemingly small, offers significant insights into the priorities and vulnerabilities of an isolated authoritarian regime like North Korea, Alex. Kim's choice of a slow-moving armored train averaging only 37 miles per hour is symbolic of his regime's deep-seated seclusion and obsession with security.
And it's tradition.
It's tradition, but also practical. It's also an opportunity to draw global attention to his diplomatic ventures. His father and grandfather also traveled by train, and this mode of transport has long been a centerpiece of North Korean propaganda, portraying leaders tirelessly working for the people.
So it's not just tradition. There's a practical security element as well. He can't fly his own plane. Is it that unsafe?
Exactly. Kim's private jet is over 40 years old and is widely seen as unsafe for long flights and highly vulnerable to attack. While he did use a chartered Air China plane for his 2018 summit with President Trump in Singapore, arriving in Beijing on a foreign aircraft for a parade attended by 24 leaders would be considered embarrassing for the regime.
The optics.
The optics, yeah. His diplomatic goals for this trip are likely twofold: to demonstrate solidarity with China and Russia, and to attract much-needed economic support from Beijing. It's also possible he's taking notes for North Korea's own military parade in October, marking the 80th anniversary of the Workers' Party. For you, our listener, these seemingly small logistical details provide a window into the careful image cultivation, security concerns, and strategic priorities of a highly secretive state on the global stage.
Moving to a more aggressive international action, President Trump disclosed that the U.S. military carried out a strike against a drug vessel from Venezuela, killing 11. Sam, how does this type of strike compare to typical U.S. anti-drug operations, and what are its broader implications? This sounds pretty direct.
This is a significant escalation of tensions with Venezuela's authoritarian government, Alex, coming just days after the Pentagon deployed warships to the Caribbean to halt the flow of cocaine. President Trump disclosed the attack during a White House news conference, promising further actions, and later posting a declassified video of the strike on Truth Social.
And who did they say they targeted?
He warned that the U.S. had targeted positively identified narco-terrorists from the Tren de Aragua cartel operating a small boat carrying drugs, resulting in 11 deaths.
So this seems like a distinct departure from standard protocols.
Yeah.
Usually they try to board, right?
It does seem different. John Feely, a former U.S. ambassador to Panama with extensive experience in anti-drug operations in Latin America, outlined typical U.S. Coast Guard policies. He explained that cutters, carrying law enforcement detachments, normally attempt to stop and board vessels. Force, such as disabling engines, is usually only used if a ship is fleeing, with every effort made to preserve life.
Not just blowing them up.
As Feely put it, what we don't do is just shoot up boats. This suggests a distinct departure from standard protocols, highlighting the aggressive nature of this specific strike. Secretary of State Marco Rubio also weighed in, stating that the president will use the full power of America to eradicate drug cartels wherever they are.
Strong words.
Very. For you, our listener, this military action in international waters has significant implications for U.S. foreign policy, drug interdiction efforts, and the potential for international escalation, particularly with a government like Venezuela.
From political tensions to natural disasters, Afghanistan has been hit by a devastating earthquake, with the death toll rising to 1,400 amid aftershocks. Sam, what are the challenges for aid efforts in such a difficult region? It sounds horrific.
This is a tragic and ongoing humanitarian crisis, Alex. The death toll from the magnitude 6.0 earthquake that struck on Sunday has risen to 1,400, and officials are warning it could increase further as rescuers struggle to reach survivors. The affected region is remote and mountainous, and many roads have been destroyed by landslides triggered by the quake, making access incredibly difficult.
Just getting there is a problem.
Exactly. The article cites the personal tragedy of Amanullah, a 47-year-old farmer who lost 7 family members, including his wife and 3 sons, when his house collapsed while they were asleep. He himself broke a leg and had to be carried for miles to a hospital.
And what are the broader humanitarian challenges, especially with aid funding cuts we've heard about?
Even with government and UN NGO relief teams on the ground, humanitarian response capacity is severely impacted by steep funding cuts from the U.S. and other donors. For instance, the termination of U.S. humanitarian funding to Afghanistan led to the closure of at least 80 health facilities serving hundreds of thousands of people in eastern Afghanistan between February and May, according to the World Health Organization.
So the infrastructure isn't there.
It's severely weakened. This drastically reduces the ability to provide emergency care and reach those in need, especially considering the critical 72-hour window for rescuing people trapped under rubble. Afghanistan is unfortunately very prone to earthquakes due to fault lines from the Arabia, Eurasia, and India plates. Just in October 2023, 2 powerful earthquakes killed 2,400 people in the region.
Yeah, a terrible situation.
For you, our listener, this highlights the immense challenges of disaster response in a politically unstable region with significant aid funding cuts, and the long-term implications for the affected communities who are left to rebuild with limited support.
Shifting to the Middle East, Israel reportedly hit a Yemen target just hours after discovering an imminent Houthi meeting, killing 12 Houthi government officials, including their prime minister and foreign minister. Sam, this reflects an aggressive new Israeli security posture, doesn't it? What's driving this escalation? Is this part of a pattern?
It absolutely does, Alex, and it seems to be. This is a clear demonstration of Israel's evolving and more aggressive security doctrine. The strike on a conference hall in Sana'a, Yemen, was carried out hours after Israeli intelligence detected plans for an imminent meeting of Houthi government ministers. This intelligence-driven preemptive action is the result of Israeli efforts to improve their intelligence gathering on the Iran-backed Houthis, who had been a blind spot for Israel before the Gaza War, and who conduct aerial attacks on Israel and Red Sea shipping.
And they have a name for this new doctrine.
Apparently so. The new doctrine, as described by one security official, is referred to among soldiers as FAFO, an acronym for F Around and Find Out, moving away from previous policies of proportional retaliation.
Right. So a deliberate shift towards a harder, earlier strike strategy. What has been the impact on the Houthis, and how have they responded? Did it cripple them?
Well, Yemen experts suggest the strike was more symbolic than substantive, hitting the administrative facade of the Houthi government rather than the core militia power. However, it will undoubtedly force surviving Houthi leaders to take new precautions to avoid detection. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz has already threatened future targets.
And the Houthi response?
The Houthis, for their part, have vowed revenge. Since the strike, they have launched at least 3 drones and a few ballistic missiles at Israel, though none reached their targets, and fired missiles at a ship near the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which also missed. Notably, they recently used cluster munitions in a missile fired towards Israel prior to this Israeli strike.
What are the broader implications of this aggressive stance for regional stability? Could it lead to a wider conflict? That seems like the big risk.
That's the fear. Israel hopes this aggressive stance will have a deterrent effect on the Houthis and other regional enemies. There's also hope within Israel that this might spur the Yemeni people, who are opposed to the Houthis, to take up arms against them. However, some analysts believe that Israel cannot sustain a long campaign against the Houthis alone and would need the U.S. to rejoin the fight. This aggressive, intelligence-driven preemptive action reshapes regional conflicts and raises important questions about the consequences of such an escalating security doctrine in an already volatile Middle East.
And within Israel itself, a critical challenge. The Israeli army is struggling to get reservists to show up as a new Gaza City offensive looms. Sam, is this simply exhaustion after nearly 2 years, or is there a deeper crisis of purpose unfolding?
It seems to be both, and it speaks to the immense strain of prolonged conflict on a nation's people and its military, Alex. As the Israeli military prepares for a new offensive on Gaza City, commanders are finding it increasingly difficult to find enough reservists willing to report for duty. The primary causes are clear. Troops are exhausted after nearly 2 years of fighting on multiple fronts, and there's growing discontent and questioning of the war's purpose. Many reservists are at a breaking point.
This is a sharp contrast to the initial outpouring of support after October 7th, 2023. People were lining up then.
A very sharp contrast, yeah. Immediately after the Hamas attack, reservists voluntarily showed up, believing they were fighting to save their country. However, that belief has gradually crumbled as the war drags on, with reservists being called up repeatedly. A master sergeant in the 98th Commando Division, who has fought for 400 days, expressed a widely held view that people are dying for nothing and that the war is being prolonged for Prime Minister Netanyahu's political survival, a charge the Prime Minister denies.
And the personal cost.
Immense. The war is Israel's longest, straining families, jobs, and the psychological well-being of many. Stories of reservists losing jobs, getting divorced, or facing financial ruin are becoming common.
Are there other factors contributing to this reluctance? Perhaps moral or ethical considerations or political ones?
Yes, definitely. There's significant frustration over the Netanyahu government pushing for a military service exemption for the ultra-Orthodox minority, which many view as unfair when others are sacrificing so much.
Oh, that's a big issue there.
It is. Commanders are resorting to unusual methods like sending out online forms where reservists can mark unavailable dates and offering more flexible models like 1 week on, 1 week off to ease the burden. The upcoming Gaza City operation will rely mainly on mandatory service soldiers, with reservists primarily replacing soldiers in Syria, Lebanon, and the West Bank, though some will still be in Gaza.
Though the burden shifts.
Right. Even Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir reportedly opposed a complete Gaza occupation, partly due to manpower issues. A smaller but significant group of reservists has also stopped showing up due to immoral behavior they witnessed against Palestinians, citing incidents like the accidental shooting of women and nonchalant discussions about disposing of bodies, which deeply affected their ethical boundaries. For you, our listener, this reveals how prolonged conflicts impact military morale, societal cohesion, and individual ethics within a nation, and underscores the profound long-term costs of such sustained strain.
This strain on Israel's military readiness brings us to a broader economic and geopolitical question. What's happening in Europe? An opinion piece in the Journal argues that its economic divergence from the U.S. comes down to a critical factor. Sam, what is it, and what's Europe missing? They seem to be falling behind.
This article provides a crucial lens through which to understand global economic shifts, Alex. While aging populations and higher energy prices have indeed worsened Europe's economic position, the core issue, as the analysis points out, is productivity. From the 1960s through the early 1990s, Europe actually steadily caught up with U.S. productivity, even surpassing American efficiency in some industries like manufacturing and telecommunications.
Right, I remember that narrative.
But since then, U.S. productivity growth has been persistently stronger, creating a widening gap.
Where did the U.S. pull ahead specifically? Is it just about tech, like Silicon Valley?
It's largely about tech, but also innovation culture. The U.S. surged decisively in the digital revolution, building global platforms in software, artificial intelligence, cloud, and semiconductors. Europe, conversely, has lagged significantly in these tech-intensive industries, often finding itself heavily dependent on U.S. platforms.
And other factors.
The article also points to contributing factors like underinvestment in defense, which limited Europe's access to military research and development spillovers that historically boosted U.S. innovation. Additionally, fragmented national markets within Europe slowed its firms from achieving the scale needed to compete effectively across the continent.
Interesting point about fragmentation.
Yeah. The paradox, as the opinion piece concludes, is that while Europe remains better at quality of life, the U.S. leads decisively in innovation, technology, and global clout. For you, our listener, understanding these fundamental differences in economic strategy and innovation is crucial for comprehending the significant performance gap between major global economies and how that might impact your future in an increasingly competitive world.
Let's delve into domestic politics and public policy, starting with a look at consumer sentiment. Sam, it appears the middle class vibe has shifted from secure to squeezed, mirroring the gloom of lower income earners. Is this a temporary blip or a deeper structural shift in the economy we're seeing?
This is a critical indicator of economic health and societal well-being, Alex, and the data suggests it's more than a blip. Consumer confidence among middle-income households, generally those making between $53,000 and $161,000 a year, has dropped sharply since June. After a brief period of optimism, their outlook now closely resembles the gloomier views of low-income earners.
And the surveys show this clearly.
Yeah. Consumer sentiment dropped nearly 6% in August, according to the University of Michigan, and pessimism about the job market increased, with more people expecting their income to decline. Morning Consult surveys specifically noted that for middle-income consumers, things fell off a cliff after June.
So are businesses seeing this directly? Are consumers truly pulling back? Are people buying less stuff?
Absolutely. CEOs across dining, retail, fashion, and airline industries are reporting strapped middle-class customers. Walmart observed middle and low-income shoppers cutting discretionary spending. Advance Auto Parts and O'Reilly Automotive noted customers cutting non-essential car repair.
Wow, even car repairs.
Yeah. Discount retailers like Dollar General and Kohl's are seeing more business from mid-tier households seeking value as customers trade down. Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta President Raphael Bostic stated that more Americans are turning to generic brands and stretching perishable goods. Even at IHOP, McDonald's, and Denny's, middle-class diners are hunting for deals while lower-income diners are staying away altogether.
And the article had a personal story.
It did. Maria Delis Santiago, a person interviewed, shared how she's canceling a trip to Puerto Rico, buying nail strips instead of salon visits, and cutting restaurant visits due to financial concerns. Real impacts.
Is this economic squeeze affecting all income brackets equally? Or are the wealthy still spending freely, insulated from this?
There's a clear divergence. High earners are still buying luxury items, such as On running shoes that start at $160 a pair, and first-class flights. United Airlines reported an increase in premium cabin revenue, while its economy cabin revenue was negative.
So a split-screen economy.
Exactly. In contrast, budget retailers like Dollar General and budget airlines like Frontier and Spirit are struggling more than high-end counterparts. The CEO of Crocs noted that less wealthy shoppers are paring back spending and are most sensitive to price increases. For you, our listener, this shift in the middle-class vibe directly affects your spending choices, highlighting broader implications for the economy and social mobility and revealing a two-tiered economic experience in America today.
Moving on to national security process, President Trump has centralized national security decisions, shrinking the National Security Council and relying on a small group of advisors, with Secretary of State Marco Rubio also serving as national security advisor. Sam, the White House defends this as top-down efficiency, but critics argue it dangerously isolates the president. What's the real trade-off here? Speed versus informed decision-making?
That's the core question, Alex, and it's a significant shift. This centralized approach has significantly curtailed the National Security Council's role. Its staff is now fewer than 150, down from around 400 in previous administrations.
That's a huge cut.
It is. The consequences of this centralization are far-reaching. U.S. diplomats were reportedly left in the dark about airstrikes on Iran's nuclear facilities in June, leading to foreign officials lacking information and U.S. embassies being unable to provide answers. Officials tasked with executing orders often lack detailed instructions, leading to delays, mistakes, or inaction, and encouraging what the article calls freelancing by senior officials.
So this isn't just about efficiency. It's about a fundamental shift in how foreign policy and national security are managed. Less process, more top-down calls.
Absolutely. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt stated it's a top-down approach, openly saying they don't really care if your feelings are hurt and are just getting a job done. Former EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland described dissenting voices as whiners in the bowels of the NSC.
Harsh words. But critics see danger.
Yes. Critics like David Rothkopf, an author on NSC history, argue that the national security process has ceased to exist, with Trump effectively being the national security system himself. They warn that this denies Trump the views of government experts that could inform better policies.
Are there specific examples of this ad hoc approach creating problems or confusion?
Yes, the article gives a few. Troy Fitchrell, a State Department Africa official, announced a high-level African gathering without White House coordination. More dramatically, Mike Waltz, the former NSA, and General Michael Kurilla, then CECOM chief, persuaded Trump to order Yemen airstrikes against his team's initial advice, only for Trump to later reverse course, even though Houthi attacks continue.
So internal disagreements leading to reversals.
Exactly. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, in his dual role, actually argued for deep staff cuts to revert the NSC to more of an interagency coordinator, which he believed suited Trump's top-down style. While proponents argue this minimizes leaks and allows swift decision implementation, it also leaves the president out of the loop sometimes.
How so?
For instance, Trump himself was reportedly surprised in July to learn the Pentagon had paused Ukraine weapons deliveries, reversing the decision a week later. White House envoy Steve Witkoff often calls Trump directly after meeting leaders, but summaries rarely filter through the government. For you, our listener, this raises critical questions about the risks and benefits of a highly centralized national security decision-making process and how it impacts U.S. foreign policy and global stability.
Now, to a politically charged topic that continues to generate headlines. Republicans have made public a tranche of Jeffrey Epstein documents. Sam, what's in these documents and what's the political context surrounding their release? There's always so much speculation around this.
This is a complex situation involving transparency, privacy, and political pressure, Alex. A House committee released over 30,000 pages of documents related to Jeffrey Epstein on Tuesday, facing ongoing pressure to make public more details on the convicted sex offender. The GOP-led House Oversight and Government Reform Committee released these documents after subpoenaing the Justice Department, emphasizing that this is just the first of several tranches.
So it's not the full story yet.
Yeah.
And what's the Democratic perspective on this release? Are they saying it's nothing new?
That's right. More are expected. However, Representative Robert Garcia, the top Democrat on the committee, stated that 97% of the documents released on Tuesday were already public. He noted that the only new disclosures were primarily Epstein's airplane travel logs from 2014 and reentry forms.
So mostly old stuff.
According to him, yes. The content includes jail cell videos from the night of his death, police reports, and court filings from his Florida sex trafficking case, as well as documents from Ghislaine Maxwell's federal cases.
It sounds like there's a push for even more information, though, from both sides, maybe.
There definitely is. House Speaker Mike Johnson and other lawmakers met with Epstein victims, and Representative Thomas Massey is pushing for legislation to force the full release of files. Lawmakers described meeting with six women as heartbreaking and infuriating, with calls for a closer look at documents and transparency while protecting victims' privacy. Victims themselves suggested the issue is a lot bigger than anyone anticipated.
And the political angle.
Trump allies have long sought the release of Epstein-related materials, and when the Justice Department stated in July that there was no client list and wouldn't release new files, it caused an uproar among some Trump supporters who believe powerful elites are being protected. Notably, the Wall Street Journal reported that Trump's name appeared multiple times in Epstein files, along with other high-profile figures, though being mentioned isn't an indication of wrongdoing. The Trump administration has called the story fake news, and Trump himself referred to the renewed interest as a hoax. For you, our listener, this case presents significant ethical and legal challenges of releasing sensitive documents and clearly demonstrates how political pressure influences transparency around high-profile cases.
From the halls of Congress to a beloved American restaurant, President Trump appears to have browbeaten Cracker Barrel into reversing a decision to change its iconic logo and overhaul its old-fashioned decor. Sam, this isn't just about a logo. It's a stark reminder of how deeply political polarization has seeped into corporate branding, isn't it?
It absolutely is, Alex, and it demonstrates how even routine business decisions can become cultural battlegrounds. Cracker Barrel's leadership had said their rebranding was about positioning the company for the future, not wokeness. However, many Trump supporters suspected wokeness and unleashed a torrent of vitriol.
And Trump weighed in.
He did, and this is where his influence became pivotal.
So he really tapped into a specific sentiment among his base. He knows that audience well.
Precisely. Cracker Barrel is described as a fixture in Trump country, with Trump winning 74% of votes in counties with a Cracker Barrel. The brand is anchored by nostalgia, making its base particularly resistant to change. Representative Byron Donalds, a Trump-endorsed candidate and former Cracker Barrel employee, supported Trump's intervention, saying, "Go back and be a good American company."
And they did go back.
They did. Following the backlash and Trump's intervention, Cracker Barrel not only reversed its logo change, but also removed a pride page and references to LGBTQ+ employee resource groups from its website, calling it the removal of out-of-date content.
This isn't the first time Trump has influenced corporate decisions, is it? Seems to be part of a broader strategy, or at least a pattern.
No, it's part of a pattern. He previously took a 10% stake in Intel after criticizing it, and Coca-Cola released a new Coke with cane sugar after his input. The Cracker Barrel situation was even likened to the Bud Light backlash in 2023. Timothy Calkins, a marketing professor at Northwestern Kellogg, noted that marketing decisions are increasingly, quote, perceived as politically driven or philosophically driven moves, turning routine changes into political statements.
Yeah, treacherous territory for brands.
For you, our listener, this episode reveals how political polarization can influence corporate branding and consumer decisions and showcases the significant power of presidential influence on popular culture.
Let's turn to a closely watched political race, Virginia's governor race. Abigail Spanberger, a moderate Democrat, is favored to win, and she's being seen by some as a politically viable face for the Democratic Party, contrasting sharply with the left-wing narrative exemplified by Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani. Sam, is she the future of the Democratic Party or an anomaly in an age of extremes?
That's a critical question, Alex, because this election is being closely scrutinized as a bellwether for the second Trump presidency, making it a critical barometer of the national political mood. Spanberger is heavily favored to flip the governorship back to Democrats after Governor Glenn Youngkin's term, as Virginia Barr's consecutive terms.
And her image.
She presents herself as a self-styled pragmatist, a former CIA case officer and mother of three, focusing her campaign on normality and serving, consciously avoiding, chaos.
She seems to be intentionally positioning herself away from the party's left wing, which is a notable strategy. Has she done that before?
She has a history of doing so, yeah.
Yeah.
After the 2020 election, she publicly castigated Democratic colleagues for embracing socialism and defunding the police. In 2021, she criticized President Biden for his expansive agenda, famously saying, "Nobody elected him to be FDR. They elected him to be normal and stop the chaos."
Strong words for her own party's president.
Right. This pushback on the left is a key part of her identity. In Congress, she was ranked as the 19th most bipartisan member of the House by the Lugar Center Georgetown, though she did vote in lockstep with Biden's agenda and backed both Trump impeachments. Her gubernatorial campaign focuses on pocketbook issues like energy, housing, and healthcare costs, largely sidestepping hot-button topics like transgender children in schools or state cooperation with federal immigration raids.
So how are the Republicans responding, and what does this mean for the Democratic Party's identity? Are they trying to paint her as extreme anyway?
The Republican nominee, Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earle Sears, is attempting to link Spanberger to Mamdani, labeling her ideas as socialist. However, Republicans are privately pessimistic about Earle Sears' campaign, citing her awkward public presence and high staff turnover. Spanberger, on the other hand, has raised more than twice as much money and vastly outpaced her opponent in TV ads, drawing robust crowds of educated liberals anxious about democracy and eager to oppose Trump.
But is her style enough for today's politics?
That's the question. This raises an important point. Is her cautious, technocratic campaign suited to an age of extremes, when some demoralized Democrats crave more of a fight? Her success or struggle will offer significant insights into the political appetite of the electorate and potentially the future direction of the Democratic Party's identity.
Let's look at an opinion piece titled California's Rideshare Stickup, which describes how California Democrats coerced a deal with Uber and Lyft to help drivers unionize, effectively circumventing a 2020 ballot initiative. Sam, how are they pulling off this legislative maneuver? It sounds like they're undoing what voters decided.
This is a prime example of clever legislative maneuvering impacting the gig economy, Alex. In 2020, California voters passed Proposition 22, which defined rideshare drivers as independent contractors, meaning they cannot unionize under federal antitrust and labor law.
Right, that was a huge fight.
It was. However, California Democrats have devised what the article calls a crafty end run, using the state action antitrust exemption. The proposed legislation would allow unions to petition the state's Public Employment Relations Board for certification, thereby enabling organization free from antitrust liability due to state oversight.
So the state basically sanctions the unionization, getting around federal law.
That seems to be the mechanism, yes. This new deal is expected not to diminish the benefits drivers already receive under Prop 22. For you, our listener, this illustrates how state politics and legislative strategies can profoundly impact the gig economy, potentially changing the working conditions for drivers you rely on and influencing the broader labor movement nationwide.
Following up on President Trump's tariff policies, an interesting letter to the editor titled "Why Trump's Emergency Tariffs Won't Fly" argues against the legal basis for these tariffs. Professor John Yu believes a federal appeals court evaded the core question. Sam, what's the central legal debate here? Is a trade deficit really an emergency?
This letter delves into some pretty intricate legal theory, Alex, but the core debate is this. Professor John Yu argues that a federal appeals court ruling against President Trump's tariffs, which cited a 1977 emergency law known as IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, actually dodged the fundamental question, whether a trade deficit genuinely qualifies as a national emergency. He contends that it does not.
What are his specific legal arguments against the trade deficit being an emergency? It seems like a trade deficit has been around for ages, not exactly sudden.
You present several key points. While the appeals court's ruling might lean on the major questions doctrine, a stand-in for the non-delegation doctrine, you point out that U.S. v. Curtis Wright, 1936, states the non-delegation doctrine doesn't apply to foreign affairs, where executive energy and speed are paramount.
Okay, so historical precedent there.
Right. He also notes that neither the appeals court nor the journal's editorial addressed Dames and Moore v. Reagan, 1981, where the Supreme Court upheld an expansive reading of IEPA for President Reagan to take economic measures during the Iranian hostage crisis. However, Yu's strongest argument is on the definition of emergency. He argues that the trade deficit does not qualify as a sudden surprise, short in duration, and great in harm, the usual characteristics of an emergency.
It's persistent, not sudden.
Exactly. The trade deficit has existed for half a century, is a similar share of GDP, and IEP is intended for national security threats, not persistent economic dynamics. He believes that while justices should reverse the appeals court's cramped reading of IEPA, they may still strike down the tariffs due to the lack of a true national emergency. For you, our listener, this highlights how legal interpretations of presidential power and emergency declarations fundamentally shape trade policy and the economy you operate within.
Let's turn to an opinion piece that offers a stark perspective on crime, titled The Simple Solution to Violent Crime, More Cops. Jason L. Riley argues that more policing means less crime and criticizes the Democratic reaction to President Trump's federal crackdown. Sam, is it truly that simple, or is there the more nuanced reality? That title feels blunt.
This article presents a very direct argument on a contentious issue, Alex, and yes, the title is blunt. Jason L. Riley asserts that empirical data supports the idea that more policing means less crime, and he is critical of the Democratic response to President Trump's federal efforts to combat crime, particularly in cities like Chicago. Chicago is cited as a prime example of the problem, with dozens of shootings over a recent holiday weekend, leaving at least 7 dead, and the city having the highest murder rate in the country for 13 years running.
How does this compare with the Chicago mayor's approach? Is it completely opposite?
Pretty much. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson has called the more police approach antiquated, instead linking crime to a lack of affordable housing. However, Riley counters this directly, citing criminological literature and studies that show a 50% increase in police, leading to a 15% decrease in crime, and private patrols decreasing crime by 43-73%.
And he argues it helps minority communities most.
He argues that increased police presence disproportionately benefits Black victims, with a twice as large decline in homicide per capita. Riley also pushes back on the idea that crime is primarily caused by poverty, stating that most poor people are not criminals, and violent crime was actually lower in eras with worse material conditions for poor Americans. He suggests that crime drives poverty by making merchants leave and shrinking the tax base, and highlights social pathology factors like family makeup and education.
So how does Trump's approach fit into this perspective? What's he actually doing?
Trump's approach, according to Riley, is about sending in reinforcements. He points to Washington, D.C., a federal district, where federal officers and National Guard deployment led to an 87% drop in carjackings, an outcome appreciated by Mayor Muriel Bowser. However, this raises an important question about the limitations of federal power.
Right. D.C. is unique.
Exactly. Trump's authority is limited in cities like Chicago, where he cannot simply direct state and local police. Chicago Mayor Johnson has stated his opposition to joint patrols with federal law enforcement or military for immigration enforcement, warning hyperbolically about grandmothers thrown into the back of unmarked vans. Riley concludes that while the National Guard isn't a long-term fix, Trump is performing a public service by calling attention to crime and pressuring local leaders to act. For you, our listener, this highlights how different political ideologies approach the complex issue of violent crime and what the real-world implications of these strategies are for the safety of your communities.
Here's an opinion piece from a familiar voice. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., as Secretary of Health and Human Services, writes that we're restoring public trust in the CDC. He attributes the agency's COVID failures to politicized science, bureaucratic inertia, and mission creep. Sam, this is a significant statement from a higher-ranking official outlining a radical shift in a core public health institution, isn't it? He's basically saying the CDC failed.
It truly is, Alex, and it's a direct critique. Kennedy's critique of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is quite sharp. He argues that the agency's dysfunction produced irrational policy during COVID, citing examples like cloth masks on toddlers, arbitrary six-foot distancing, boosters for healthy children, prolonged school closings, lockdowns, and the suppression of low-cost therapeutics.
And he blames this for poor outcomes.
He dramatically points out that America, with 4.2% of the world's population, suffered 19% of COVID deaths. He also notes the CDC has presided over rising chronic disease and declining life expectancy since 2014, leading to a collapse of public trust with very low participation rates in recent COVID booster programs.
So his mandate from President Trump is to restore that trust and refocus the CDC. What are the new priorities, and how will this change impact public health? What's the new vision?
President Trump, according to Kennedy, asked him to restore trust and return the CDC to its core mission. Kennedy outlines that the CDC, which started in 1946 as the Communicable Disease Center to eradicate malaria, had its mission grow piecemeal over decades, duplicating work of other HHS agencies. Under this renewed vision, the CDC will focus on six key priorities. First, protect from threats, enhancing respiratory disease surveillance and utilizing a biothreat radar.
Oh.
Second, build infrastructure, strengthening global and domestic systems for prediction, tracking, and response. Third, modernize systems, upgrading data, labs, and epidemiology for 21st century threats. Fourth, invest in workforce, rebuilding the disease detectives through training epidemiologists.
The classic EIS officers.
Exactly. Fifth, enhance scientific rigor, applying gold standard science to recommendations and ensuring safe, effective vaccines. And sixth, empower states and communities, returning to its original mission of supporting state and local health departments.
And actions taken already.
Kennedy states they have already taken steps to eliminate conflicts of interest, shaken up the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and replace leaders who resisted reform. For you, our listener, this outlines how a shift in leadership and mission for a critical public health agency could impact national health policy, potentially redefining scientific guidance and influencing your trust in health information.
Let's consider another opinion from Holman W. Jenkins, Jr., titled Trump's Disoriented Democrats. Yeah. He argues that despite Trump's vulnerabilities, Democrats are a demoralized mess and a dysfunctional opposition, lacking moral self-possession and seriousness. Sam, is this a fair assessment, or is he missing the nuances of current Democratic challenges? He sounds pretty critical.
This opinion piece offers a critical assessment of the current political landscape from a specific viewpoint, Alex, and yes, it's very critical. Jenkins highlights what he perceives as a series of Democratic failures: fabricating the Steele dossier, lying about Hunter Biden's laptop, attempting to hide Joe Biden's senility, and almost losing to Trump in 2024 despite these issues. He frames this as the remarkable nature of Mr. Trump's vulnerability, juxtaposed with, quote, the Democrats' inability to put forward a useful, loyal opposition.
So he's suggesting a lack of seriousness and effectiveness from the Democratic Party. They just can't land a punch.
That's the core of his argument. He cites examples like Russia scholar Ann Applebaum still asking, what does Vladimir Putin have on Mr. Trump? Despite the Steele dossier being discredited, which he calls a microcosm of this lack of seriousness, he argues that Europe also exhibits this, opposing Ukraine and NATO while shifting security responsibility to the U.S.
And his view of Trump's style.
Jenkins characterizes Trump's style as a 70s police sci class come to life, focused on who gets what, inserting himself as an arbiter, and extracting his vig. He sees Trump's fatal flaw as not thinking through long-run consequences.
What's his broader prediction for the political economy? Does he see trouble ahead?
Jenkins predicts a future characterized by a megatrend of taking stuff away, referring to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, which he sees as underpinning both Magee and what he calls democratic brain-dead leftism. He also foresees the return of war as Russia and China exploit Western fiscal dilemmas.
Grim outlook.
Very. He calls for more honesty from Democrats, suggesting they should acknowledge their role in lawfare and address hypocrisy, for instance, by repenting for opening Pandora's box while condemning Trump's use of similar tactics. For you, our listener, this opinion piece highlights how perceived strengths and weaknesses of political parties can profoundly influence the national discourse and the effectiveness of checks and balances in government, painting a rather stark picture of the political future.
Let's shift now to society, culture, and life, and a heartbreaking story from California. Malibu's beloved Reel In restaurant, which was destroyed by the Palisades fire in January, has been told it can't rebuild on its leased site. Sam, this is a devastating blow for a community institution, isn't it? Just gone.
It truly is, Alex. This is a devastating blow for a community institution and a poignant reminder of how natural disasters can have ripple effects far beyond the initial destruction. The Reel Inn had been operated for 36 years by Teddy Seraphine Leonard and Andy Leonard, building a loyal following for its unique vibe, punny signs, and chalkboard menus. It truly was a beloved local landmark.
Why are they being denied the ability to rebuild? Is it bureaucratic red tape or something else? It seems unfair.
It's a combination of bureaucratic hurdles and practical considerations. The California Department of Parks and Recreation, which owns the leased site, cited several reasons. Primarily, there's now less space available, and a competitive bidding process is required even for temporary services, like a food truck for 2 to 3 years, due to the need for transparency and accountability for public land.
And utilities are involved.
Yes. Additionally, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power is using part of the site as a staging ground for 2 years to restore the electric grid. The owners, who received $1.2 million in insurance for lost income and $1.1 million for rebuilding, used the money to help their 22 long-term employees, most of whom have had to find new jobs, often at lower pay.
That's rough for the staff.
Very. For instance, kitchen manager Godsfat Lopez is now earning $7 an hour less at LAX. Despite a GoFundMe raising $200,000 for the staff, the owners have declined offers to join other restaurants or open a new location, feeling it's just not the same. They are, however, working on a cookbook and bottling their Chipotle sauce.
Well, that's something.
For you, our listener, this story illustrates how natural disasters, coupled with bureaucratic hurdles and economic realities, can irrevocably impact small businesses and the cherished local institutions that help define a community.
Now, for a headline that makes you stop and think. Americans, all of us, are having less sex than ever. Sam, is this just a cheeky headline, or is there something genuinely profound and perhaps worrying happening in our society? A sex recession.
This is a truly fascinating and somewhat concerning societal trend, Alex. A new study by the Institute for Family Studies, analyzing 2024 general social survey data, indicates that only 37% of people aged 18-64 reported having sex at least once a week, down from 55% in 1990.
Wow, that's a big drop.
Huge. The decline is even more stark for young adults. 24% of 18-29-year-olds had no sex in the past year, which is double the rate from 2010. This isn't just a young person phenomenon. The study shows it holds true across all age groups up to 64, all sexual orientations, and both married and single individuals.
What are the experts attributing this to? It sounds like a complex web of modern stressors. Is it just screens?
It's a confluence of factors, both long-term and more recent. Decades-long trends include declining marriage and cohabitation rates, as people who live with romantic partners generally have more sex. Screen addiction is another major factor, with experts noting people are bid-rotting staring at screens rather than interacting with partners.
Bid-rotting, huh?
Yeah. Adding to this is a post-pandemic malaise. While sexual activity briefly picked up after lockdowns, current rates are even lower than during the pandemic. Therapists cite a struggle to rebuild social lives, navigate work-life balance, and manage a growing sense of uncertainty about the world.
So anxiety and stress are big parts.
Definitely. Shadeen Francis, a sex therapist, notes a long-term atrophy of the skills it takes to maintain relationships, while Lee Phillips points to a heightened fight-or-flight response because of all the chaos. Many individuals cited practical reasons, including parenting exhaustion, relationship issues, age, economic worries, stress from the news, unhealthy attachment to screens, concerns about reproductive rights, and the expense and disappointment of dating.
It sounds like a real challenge for modern relationships, but why is this considered so important for our overall well-being? Is it really that big a deal?
Therapists emphasize the importance of sex for overall well-being. It's said to boost the immune system, relieve stress, aid sleep, connect partners, increase happiness, and even add meaning to life. So, for those looking to address this sex recession, the advice is practical. For singles, focus on meeting people in real-life settings doing things you love. For partners, go to bed at the same time as opportunity fuels action.
Put the phone down.
And crucially, put down the screens. The first thing you touch should be your partner, not your phone. Psychologist Lori Mintz offers a relatable analogy. Prioritizing sex is like going to the gym. Sometimes you feel like you don't want to do it, but you always feel better afterwards. For you, our listener, these trends offer a compelling insight into modern life, relationships, and well-being, and perhaps even some actionable advice for your own life or community.
From the bedroom to the pantry, let's talk about food trends. Fiber-packed foods are hitting store shelves everywhere, but doctors are raising an alarm, cautioning us to be careful. Sam, while natural fiber is great, doctors are warning that too much added processed fiber can surprisingly cause inflammation and even gut issues for some people. How can something that sounds so healthy be problematic?
This is a crucial health topic, Alex, as it delves into the nuances of nutrition and the potential pitfalls of food trends. Doctors and researchers are increasingly concerned about the proliferation of fiber-enriched foods and supplements, especially as fiber-maxing trends on social media. Manufacturers are adding fiber to everything from soda and energy drinks to donuts and snack bars.
That go with fiber?
Yep. The core issue is the significant difference between natural high-fiber foods like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, and these processed fiber-enhanced products. While natural fiber is generally good for us, and most people don't get enough, helping with satiety, cholesterol, blood sugar, and reducing disease risks, the added processed fibers can be a different story.
So more fiber is not always better. That goes against conventional wisdom, right? Eat more fiber.
Exactly. Overdoing it with processed fiber is the concern. While fiber typically reduces inflammation, some added fibers can actually cause inflammation in certain individuals, leading to complaints of bloating and pain. There's also a health halo effect, where added fiber makes otherwise unhealthy products, often high in sugar and emulsifiers, seem healthier to consumers.
People think it cancels out the bad stuff.
Kind of. A Nielsen IQ survey found that 53% of consumers plan to buy more high-fiber foods in 2025, driven by this perception.
Are there specific types of added fiber that are causing particular concern? Like, what should we watch out for?
Yes. Inulin, often derived from chicory root, is one such fiber. Research, primarily in animals at Georgia State, links it to altering the immune system and possibly increasing the risk of liver cancer. Stanford research in humans has also found it can alter liver enzymes.
Whoa, liver cancer.
Scientists caution that these studies are small and animal research doesn't always translate, but the results are concerning enough to warrant a warning. Additionally, consuming large amounts of only one or two types of fiber, common in processed foods, can lead to excessive growth of specific gut bacteria, disrupting the overall microbiome balance. Inulin, or fructooligosaccharides, in particular, can cause inflammation, pain, and bloating in some people, and may even exacerbate conditions like MS and GI disorders.
So what's the takeaway?
The strong recommendation from dietitians and researchers is clear. Get your fiber from whole, natural foods. As Dr. Sean Spencer of Stanford Medicine puts it, just eating an apple is probably the best fiber supplement you can imagine. For you, our listener, this highlights how food trends and marketing claims influence your health choices and underscores the importance of understanding the underlying science behind dietary advice.
Let's talk about our most personal devices. There are new tools emerging to make sure your cell phone is secure, but also the perennial question, should you upgrade your iPhone or just fix your old one? Sam, with cyber threats becoming increasingly sophisticated, how can we best protect our digital lives on our most personal device? It feels like a constant battle.
This is incredibly relevant for anyone with a smartphone, Alex, given the rising sophistication of cyber threats. Mobile-specific attacks, from fake toll road messages to AI-powered robocalls and SIM swaps, where criminals trick carriers into transferring your phone number to their SIM to hijack your digital life, increased by 50% in 2024. Artificial intelligence is making fraud even more complex.
Scary stuff.
It is. So phone makers, carriers, and software developers are upping their game significantly.
What are some of these new security tools we should know about? Anything automatic?
For call screening, Apple's forthcoming iOS 26 will include a call screening feature that automatically screens calls from unknown numbers, asks them to state their name and reason, and transcribes the message on screen for you to decide whether to answer. Android's scam detection does something similar, but analyzes calls in real time on device for suspicious requests, alerting you privately.
And the carriers are helping.
Yes. Carrier apps like AT&T ActiveArmor, Verizon Call Filter, and T-Mobile Scam Shield are also evolving, blocking known fraud, labeling spam, and offering categorized call management. Google Messages' new AI system can sift through text like a human, spotting common scam patterns, even with misspellings.
SIM swapping is a particularly nasty threat.
Yeah.
Are there new protections for that? Because that seems devastating.
Absolutely, and it is devastating. Carriers are responding with Account Lock, features AT&T Wireless Account Lock, and similar from Verizon and T-Mobile, which lock your wireless account, preventing invasive transactions like SIM swaps until you manually unlock it. Experts call this a simple, powerful defense that everyone should enable.
Okay, good tip.
Android 16's Key Verifier detects when a contact's message comes from a device other than their original SIM-linked phone, flagging potential impersonation. And for physical theft, Android's Theft Detection Lock automatically locks your phone if it senses sudden jerks and acceleration, a telltale sign of snatch-and-run theft, even before a thief can activate airplane mode.
Now to the iPhone dilemma. New model or repair? If you're like me, you're always wondering if that new model is really worth it. What's the advice?
The general recommendation is probably not. Usually it's better to repair or update. You can save hundreds and extend your phone's life. You should consider upgrading if your iPhone is more than 6 years old, as iOS 26 won't support iPhone XS, XS Max, XR, or older, posing a security risk.
Okay, so security is the cutoff.
Pretty much. If you have a 2019 or newer model, just update to iOS 26, which brings new features like a live translator and spam call screener, though Apple Intelligence features like ChatGPT via Siri and Genmoji will only be on iPhone 15 Pro, iPhone 16 models, and new models.
What about repairing common issues like a cracked screen or back glass? Is it worth it?
Repairing can be quite cost-effective. A cracked screen through Apple runs $199, $33, $79, but independent shops can be cheaper, though quality varies. Look for soft OLED screens. Broken back glass is trickier, costing $199, $499 at Apple, often requiring a housing swap to maintain water resistance.
Now, water resistance is key.
Right. Cameras are simpler repairs. $169, $249 at Apple, or around $50 at independent shops using aftermarket parts. For more complex issues like water damage, start with an Apple consultation, but independent shops might offer more creative, cost-effective solutions. Repair options include Apple stores, fast, in-person, mail-in service, DIY kits for the savvy, or local repair shops. Just be sure to vet technicians on parts, water resistance, and warranty. So for you, our listener, this means weighing how you can best protect your digital life on your most personal device and when it's truly worth upgrading your tech versus repairing what you already have.
Let's quickly round out our look at life and arts with a few notable headlines. Musically, indie darlings Big Thief are exploring new sounds on their sixth LP, Double Infinity, a charming but tentative evolution from their acclaimed previous work. On television, BritBox offers Linley, a four-part series featuring a highborn sleuth and his insubordinate partner.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see how artists evolve and how new adaptations of beloved characters fare. The exploration of new sound for Big Thief and the dynamic between Linley and Havers both speak to the ongoing innovation and reinterpretation in the creative arts.
In sports, Bill Belichick got schooled in his college football debut at North Carolina, raising questions about whether the legendary NFL coach has the patience for the modern college game. That sounds rough.
Yeah, a tough start for him. But on a more positive note, Naomi Osaka is making an unexpected comeback at the U.S. Open, reaching the quarterfinals for the first time since 2021, showcasing her renewed focus and form. Good for her.
Absolutely.
These sports stories highlight the extreme pressures and unforgiving nature of top-tier competition, whether it's the challenge of adapting a legendary NFL coach to the college game or the mental and physical resilience required for an elite tennis player to make a comeback.
And finally, a few thoughts on academia and broader societal topics. A Harvard professor notes that college has become almost anti-intellectual, with student performance declining despite more A's, suggesting students aren't engaging deeply due to a lack of poor grades. That's a provocative thought.
It is. And a letter on AI won't eliminate scarcity argued that AI won't eliminate jobs as long as human desires exist, unless it becomes so productive that prices drop to zero and income is unnecessary. Also, some interesting letters responding to previous pieces, one about gratitude to a professor 49 years later, and another arguing Justice Scalia knew science wasn't a shortcut in legal reasoning.
Good stuff.
These varied pieces, from the state of higher education to the implications of AI, offer a rich tapestry of societal introspection. They underscore fundamental questions about how we acquire knowledge, evaluate expertise, and prepare for an evolving future. #outro.
Wow, what a journey through today's Wall Street Journal. From the high stakes of tech antitrust and global energy deals to the struggles of our middle class and even the shifts in our personal lives, it's clear the world is moving at an incredible pace. So much to digest.
Indeed. Each of these stories, whether it's the nuances of geopolitical negotiations or the very personal decision of upgrading your iPhone, offers a window into the larger trends that shape our daily realities and future possibilities.
What stands out to you, our listener? From this deep dive, which of these stories will resonate most with your own experiences, your work, or your decisions in the coming days?
Several key themes emerge today. First, tech's enduring power. Google's antitrust win highlights the ongoing influence of tech giants, even as new AI challenges emerge, and shows the careful balance judges must strike in complex markets. Second, the economic squeeze. The shift in middle-class sentiment, corporate earnings driven by cost-cutting, and the rise of discount retailers like Aldi all point to sustained economic pressure on consumers.
Yeah, that squeeze feels real.
Third, geopolitical realignments. The Russia-China pipeline deal and the backfiring India tariffs underscore how global power dynamics and sanctions are reshaping trade and alliances, often with unintended consequences. And finally, societal shifts. From the sex recession reflecting modern stress to the ethical challenges in corporate leadership and the persistent issues in public education, our social fabric is undergoing profound changes.
As we've seen today, from a CEO's personal choices impacting a global brand, to a judge weighing in on tech monopolies, and even the motivations behind a national security team, decisions at every level ripple through our world. Consider this. In an era where information spreads instantly and impacts are far-reaching, where do you draw the line between personal accountability, corporate responsibility, and governmental oversight, and how does that inform the kind of world you want to live in?
Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. We hope this exploration has given you a fresh perspective and equipped you with insights to navigate the days ahead. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and stay well informed.